Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Ethics Experts. We are on today with Gary Ernster from WakeMed. And welcome, Gary.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Thank you so much for making time for us today. We're excited to get you on the Ethics Experts, and we'd love to jump in. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into the ethics and compliance game? Maybe give us a little bit of your history and tell us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. I'll first give you a disclaimer that keeps the lawyers happy, but be happy to get into that. But just know that my commentary today is based upon my thoughts and opinions and do not reflect that of WakeMed Health and Hospital Systems. But with that said, I started in compliance while in the pharmaceutical industry under my good friend and mentor, Steve Vinci, who really is and was a pioneer in the ethics and compliance space at TAP Pharmaceuticals in the early 2000s. And when we were at TAP, we were under an $875 million settlement agreement with the DOJ and the OIG for market conduct. And it was the largest of its kind to date at the time. Steve knew that it was important to embed integrity and compliance across the organization and pulled me onto his team because he knew that as a former sales executive, he understood that you have to sell compliance to an organization. You really have to stick the landing on the training and communication element, which is one of the seven elements of an effective compliance program as defined by the OIG. He then just kind of threw me the keys to the training and communication piece and turned me loose. And to that end, we were effectively able to communicate out an ethics and compliance message such that it was one factor in the OIG ending our CIA one full year early before its 7-year term.
Oh.
I've since helped out other pharmaceuticals. I'm sorry?
I said that's a big deal.
It really is, and it was at the time because the government was really, really sticklers about a lot of things, and settlement agreements weren't really that common, even though they are today. But I've since helped out other pharmaceutical companies prevent issues from occurring, and I'm now at the WakeMed Health and Hospital Systems, where we recently came out from under a settlement agreement that started in 2013.
Wow, that's great. That's kind of a rich experience in this game. You've seen a lot. Can you tell us a little bit about WakeMed, just from an organizational size, and tell us some of the nuance of your organization and perhaps speak to some of the kind of challenges that are on your plate.
Sure. WakeMed is a trauma center, trauma centers. They've got three main hospitals throughout the community and a host of physician practices and urgent care clinics. So we really do canvas the Raleigh area, Wake County, in particular. I mean, we're expanding out and growing. WakeMed, I think, is the best hospital entity, I think, in the state of North Carolina. We're a not-for-profit entity, and are really doing the types of things in the community that put the patient and the family first, and that is that's our mission. We're led by Donald Ginzig, who is a former naval officer. I believe he was a commander, and he's really brought a lot, I think, of attention and order to the process. And everyone at WakeMed has really bought into that philosophy of putting the patient and the families first, and that's what we do. And I think we're the primary, and I think the ultimate deliverers of healthcare in I think the state of North Carolina.
Yeah, I think you guys do a nice job of preserving that purpose of being a servant to those patients and not letting the machine itself become the big thing, but keeping the patient as the big thing. I think that's a really big deal and something that WakeMed really does a nice job with.
I totally agree, and I got to tell you too, Nick, is that it's really good being part of an extended family, because I really do feel like that's what we've got going here at Wake Med. I really believe that.
Yeah. And, you know, part of what we're all talking about is kind of culture. And, you know, when you're using terms like an extended family to describe your work family, that speaks to a rich culture, an actual authentic culture that is actually seems to be driving behavior. So, you know, we kind of view Wake Med as a hospital system, or a healthcare provider that, you know, gets it. So, you know, that's part of why we're so excited to get you on the Ethics Experts today. So this is part of our vendor pain point series. And we'd love to get some perspective from you around this whole vendor issue, right? Over the last 20 years, we've seen this disintegration as organizations. This is largely across all aspects of the economy, this disintegration as organizations now sort of more focus on their core competencies and outsource non-core functions to third-party providers who specialize in that particular function. Sometimes that's due to focus, sometimes that's due to sort of cost savings and budget, sometimes it's due to regulatory requirements or best practices and so forth. But, you know, rewind back 50 years, the vendor landscape or the amount of sort of lines between a main organization and its various vendors have just increased exponentially. So over that time, we've seen a lot of sort of challenges come along with that. And we'd love to hear a bit about, you know, Wake Med's philosophy, how you deal with the vendor thing, what sort of things you look for, and what sort of best practices you've put into place.
Sure, sure. No, I totally agree with everything you said about the vendor space. And I think it goes to the point of, you know, where organizations such as ours, I mean, we're certainly, you know, we may be in different industries or whatever. Companies today just are faced with a very fast-paced environment. And oftentimes vendors are brought in to help support the core mission or support its ancillary functions. And not oftentimes do vendors actually get a sense of that mission, or, you know, they're guns for hire. They're there for a short period. But, you know, we at Wake Med really take the long view of our relationships with vendors and really hope to work with them over, you know, a long period of time. We take the long view of that. And it starts off with great relationships. And I think it's one that we have. And then I think, you know, if there's the match on the service side and there's the match on the personal side, then I think that's the perfect formula for win-win. And that's kind of the magic in the sauce. I mean, that's the lightning in the bottle moment that you're looking for. You want a vendor that gets you, and you want to get the vendor. And you know, Wake Med is always encouraging us to have that ongoing communication so that we can make sure that we're at the tip of the steer, tip of the spear when issues do come up, so that we can head them off before they become big ones.
So I just kind of thought of this, but this is kind of this new kick that I'm on. Well, it's maybe a new hypothesis I have that I just kind of keep seeing everywhere, and I'm kind of think it might be true. And it is the statement that how you do anything is how you do everything. And as you described your internal culture, you talked about certain values, and you talked about an extended family, and you talked about how the leader of your organization brought some really great best practices that helped to sort of strengthen the fabric or strengthen the tapestry that is, you know, Wake Med and all the people involved. And then as you started to talk about the vendor angle of your business, you talked about taking the long view, and you talked about the encouragement from the top about trying to, you know, capture that lightning in the bottle that, you know, you talked about or that you mentioned. And I think it's kind of interesting because there's a similar ethos on both sides of that, both in terms of the culture that you're developing and the need for sort of true harmony on the vendor front. And I'd love to hear you kind of speak to that a little bit.
Right. No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, I've been around long enough and have been on the sales side of it that, there's two great days in your life, right? The day that you get an account and the day that you lose an account. And
it's like a boat.
Just like a boat. And you never want to be on that latter side of the equation where you as a salesperson, a person who provides services, you kiss off, you know, quite thankfully, a client that's a huge pain, but you don't want to be one either. And I think that reasonable asks along the way in that long-term relationship really do add value to that relationship. And really, I can compliment, you know, the compliance line and you know, sanction check for the fact that it was one relationship that I've had with vendors over the course of me being in healthcare for close to 40 years now, where you were one of the first companies to ever come and say, how can we do things better? And having reviewed the exclusion screening process and getting up to speed on that, really kind of had a broad view of the landscape and had some best practices, and I offered them to you all, and you guys right away just implemented some of these steps and really, I think, jumped in, you know, full force, both feet, and really upped the game and really brought a lot of oomph to the table. And that was really good, not only to be heard, but to see that practice kind of fulfill itself. And that's not always the case with vendors, because oftentimes I think vendors are very inflexible in their approach and they don't take that long view or that long-term mission under consideration.
Well, I thank you so much for those kind words. You know, I think that the reason that your ethos, I think the reason that we have such a great relationship is because we kind of both come from organizations that have similar ethos, right? I mean, we're always talking about that long-term view. And we're always, you know, again, kind of like your organization, we know what the big thing is. And the big thing is, you know, serving the client. And, you know, in your case, the client is the patient. And in our case, the client is you. And in order to take that long-term view, you got to be flexible. You know, how frustrating is it when you go to a restaurant and you need to do a substitution for a dietary restriction or something, and the chef says, well, I don't know substitutions. I mean, it's just insane. It's an insane thing. And it's a picture of, to your point, this vendor relationship, and that inflexibility just never made any sense to us.
Right, right. No, I totally agree. And I think that I've read a lot lately about the power of three. And there's a lot of information that's out there. But, you know, when vendors and providers such as us come together, the benefit, or the person who benefits the most for us, and I think ultimately for you, are the patient, the families that I was talking about earlier, the heart of what we do here at Wake Med. And I think that Donald, and I think that my direct leadership team, Ted Lodgen, who's our chief compliance officer, and Joanna Spruill, who's my direct manager, director, they take that view that it's always about continued improvement as well. I mean, you know, you can get it right the first time, but you gotta continually kind of, you know, scrub the decks down and keep washing it down and just keep getting better and better and better. And that's what we do, that's what you do. And that's where I think there's that synergy, that harmony between us that I think works really, really well.
So let me ask you this. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there that are beating their heads against the wall with the vendors that they have. And, you know,
right.
We're talking about these non-core things being outsourced and these things look really great on paper and all that kind of stuff. What kind of advice would you give to somebody who's dealing with a tough vendor situation like I'm describing?
Sure. You know, I think that honest and open communication, I think, is the place to start. And to really keep things simple. I mean, if you can, I mean, And listen, I'm not the smartest guy in the world for sure. And a lot of times I have to tell people that I deal with, talk to me like I'm a fifth grader, break it down, make it very simple. Because I think in this industry, we tend to overcomplicate things, and that it doesn't need to be that way. But I think you need to simply ask the vendors or vendor, you know, for the ask. I mean, you have to ask them for services or for maybe slight gives in their current situation that hopefully the vendor will be able to to do. And I think inflexibility on the vendor part is one of the biggest issues that on this side of the table that you deal with, because you may ask for something very simple, and sometimes an organization or a vendor just it may be outside their playbook or their comfort zone, and they don't do it, and all of a sudden, you know, you're tasked with a particular issue or a problem to solve, and you're unable to do so. And then right away, you're already thinking, well, maybe I need to start looking around. And, right. You know, you don't want to do that. That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of talent, and it takes your treasure too. Not only yours, but it moves ours to another thing. And it's another whole process or project that you have to learn. And there's that hockey stick curve in learning a new vendor product.
Right.
And oftentimes people come in and they overpromise and they oversell too.
So what are some things that you look for in a new vendor relationship, or when you're looking to find a new vendor, what are some of those, I guess we're always talking about red flags. So I'd like to talk about red flags, but I'd also like to talk about green flags. Like, what are some things that sure. you hear or see where you're like, okay, I got a good feeling about this vendor, or what are some things where you're like, okay, we need to kind of cut bait and run immediately?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, the things that I look for are just that ability for them to clearly communicate their mission and the purpose and the deliverables on a very simple and a basic level. I mean, and you shouldn't, maybe those vendors should have their own elevator speech too. And then to be able to demonstrate that in some capacity with someone else somewhere else. So I think references become, I think, key and important. I think that while a lot of times vendors may promise a lot of things on the outset that may sound impossible, and when they do that, I think you have to ask them to prove it to you. And not oftentimes can a vendor do that. And maybe that's just peculiar to an individual who's trying to maybe oversell the product, but you want to make sure that the organization stands behind the things that they say. So I think those are some red flags. I think the green flags are the things that, like communication, the ability to go right to the top of the organization to talk about issues, to talk about ways that not only they can get better, but to have them come back to you to say, hey, maybe you can do things a certain way that'll help you get better as well. Because, you know, we're always trying to internally get better here at Wake Med. But if someone can lend an outside in perspective, that helps me a lot too, because that allows me to be a value add to Wake Med as an organization. Because I think that's one thing that you have to do, and you have to be able to, it's one thing to know how to take care of problems when they exist, but I think it's quite another thing to be able to proactively stop problems before they happen. And I think, again, that's part of your value to the organization.
So, you know, we've been talking a lot about this vendor stuff, and these are great things to look at. I think, you know, the thing that really stood out to me were two pieces. One was when you were talking about, can this vendor clearly communicate not only their mission, but their value proposition? I mean, we're kind of talking about their ethos. We're talking about their heart or their approach. So being able to kind of clearly communicate that is critical. And I think a way that you can know if that's clearly communicated is if you can clearly convey that to somebody else on your team. If it takes you, you know, 10,000 words to convey this thing, then it clearly wasn't clearly communicated, right? And then the other thing you said was talking about, you know, communication and being able to prove it to you. You know, it's so hard, because I mean, we deal with this ourselves, you know, everyone's a salesperson, everyone's trying to sell, everyone has the best product ever and the best service and all that stuff. But being able to kind of cut through that salesmanship to get down to the core is super critical, because we're not in the business of managing vendors. We're in the business of providing service or providing, you know, value or doing the thing that we're actually hired to do, not to handle vendors or arm wrestle vendors or find yet another vendor to replace the one who just dropped the ball. So that communication piece is super critical. And then you touched on one other piece that I thought was interesting, was that, you know, if to the extent that there's an overlap between an ethos or a drive toward continuous improvement, and there's that communication piece, that opens up the channels for best practices to be passed over to you on the client side for you yourself to provide more value to your team and to your broader organization?
There is no question about that. There's no question about the fact that if you have that open line of communication and that a vendor such as yourself can kick it back to us and say, hey, have you thought about something? Have you thought about doing your business in a certain way? Or here's what we see that might be a good practice in your particular area or field or industry. And I think all the time our individuals looking for that. They want to be able to take those nuggets, those things that you provide to us, whether it's tangible or intangible, and bring those back to management and implement those. And if you can make us look smarter and help us in our process, hey, we're all for that.
Right.
And I think that's a two-way street as well.
So, you know, this is our big year. We want to try to elevate ethics and compliance and HR to be the strategic levers that we know they can be. We've seen that in our own lives, how sort of affecting culture and affecting, you know, the lives of people, empowering them, has created a massive amount of value in our organization and gotten everyone kind of pointing in the right direction. It seems though, sort of broadly, ethics and compliance and HR in particular are looked at as sort of a check the box function at the C-suite level. And, you know, we always talk about how when there are cuts to be made, no CEO is saying, all right, we need to cut our marketing budget, or we got to get rid of some salespeople. They're always looking for areas that are cost centers to cut costs from. And I'd love for you to speak to that. It seems like, you know, from our perspective, WakeMed is an organization that's kind of on the other side of the fence of this thing that I'm talking about. WakeMed seems to kind of get it. But what do you think that's rooted in? What do you think that lack of light bulbs on at the top around the strategic potential that these functions I'm talking about can have on their organization? What is that, you know, light being unplugged rooted in your mind? And what can folks do who are in similar positions that you're in organizations where that light bulb is off to help kind of turn that dimmer switch on?
Right. No, that's a great question. And I can tell you that in my profession, I mean, I've been through, when I was in pharma, I went through 4 mergers in 6 years. And each time they looked to the ethics and compliance department to make cuts in personnel. And I'm just scratching my head thinking, you know, listen, laws and rules and regulations are they're only going to get worse.
Right.
So why would you want to do that? And I think that it, you know, when organizations look at cost centers, I think the question needs to be asked, you know, what's the cost of not having a good ethics and compliance department? Well, you know, last time I checked in the pharmaceutical world, the cost of not having a good compliance program, or at least not monitoring that function, cost GlaxoSmith $3 billion in a settlement agreement. And, you know, that was several years ago. So, I mean, that may be an old number. But I think that, for us at WakeMed, it's it might be a cost center. And again, as a not-for-profit, I mean, that's a particularly sensitive area, but there's that broad mindset that, you know what, if we spend some money here, then that's going to help us from settlement dollars that are surely down the road. And we always train and we always educate and we always communicate as if we're going to be under a settlement agreement again tomorrow. And we go on offense, because it's that old saying, you're either on offense or defense.
Right.
And, you know, we're on offense, and we've got great leadership here who have given us the tools, who have given us, you know, the go ahead to do the types of things, to ask the hard types of questions, to audit in particular areas, to set our work plan to what the OIG sets their work plan as, and to aggressively go after it and really, you know, being under a settlement agreement, man, or dealing with the OIG is not a pleasant experience.
Mm-mm.
And we don't want that again. That's for doggone sure.
Yeah, that's a snake that you want to never bite you, let alone twice, right?
Boy, that's for sure.
So how can someone who's in an ethics compliance office in an organization where that light is not on, how do you think they can help influence the person at the top for them to see that, you know, ENC is not just a seatbelt, it can also be a spoiler for the organization. Spoiler meaning like, sure, go faster? Okay, right.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I think that if a person is in that position, I think they have to do a landscape search within their organization of some high-risk areas. And then you really start have to ask hard questions of individuals. Are we prepared for this? And I think there's enough evidence, there's enough literature, there's enough statistics, there's enough living examples in the business community and professional community and personal examples of individuals who got in trouble for the same types of activity or conduct that maybe this particular organization has not experienced yet. Right. And, you know, we know the government's out there. It's and for an individual in an organization who's up against a challenge like that, you really do have to take the mindset, it's not if, but when. And then really kind of attack it at that point. And hopefully sometime or somewhere you'll hit, you know, sympathetic ears or individuals who are able to help you move that ball. And it's a slow roll to start, but I think once you get the gravity going, then you get stakeholders at the table who are keenly interested in hopefully not that year-to-year evaluation process, but in that long-term game as well, so that, you know, the business won't suffer, individuals won't suffer, because we know that, you know, the government is tired of making examples of corporations. Now they're looking to make examples of individuals by sticking individuals in prison. And they've in as much said so. So it becomes not point. It becomes very.
That's actually help turn some light bulbs on, right?
Right, and there's plenty of information out there. It's not like it's a first. That's for sure.
Exactly. Well, this has been phenomenal, Gary. I just appreciate so much your time. I appreciate these best practices that you pushed out, and you know, it coming from someone who I think gets it, in my, you know, not so humble opinion, I guess. Coming from an organization that gets it, an organization that's empowered its ethics and compliance department to be that strategic lever, it's really a breath of fresh air to hear it. And you know, again, that's what we're here to do this year. We're really trying to elevate this function, because you know, if we're going to make the world a better workplace, it's going to start with empowering the organizations within organizations who are able to affect the people in that workplace. And that's really the ethics and compliance department. That's really the HR department, because those people are the ones who touch culture. They touch people directly. So this was really a powerful episode. And I don't know, we're going to have a bunch of clips from this one. So thanks. Thanks so much, Gary.
Thank you, Nick. I totally 100% agree with everything you just said. And really it's my pleasure. To deal with your staff and, you know, everything that you bring to the table, because you help make our organization what it is as well. You're one of the pillars of the things that we do well, and one of the things that we can have faith in and trust every day, because it's an unsure world out there, and one of the things we can count on are great relationships with good people.
Well, thank you so much, Gary, for those kind words. Thank you for your time, for being so generous with your time and with your wisdom. And we look forward to having you on again, and hopefully in a future series.
Anytime, Nick, you just let me know.
All right, Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, so bye-bye. We'll wrap that up. We'll trim it up. That was freaking phenomenal, Gary. That was like so good. It, you know, it didn't sound salesy. I mean, it sounded really genuine, and like the stuff that you talked about was so freaking cool. We just put a white paper together. We'll share it with you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. It's a little bit long, but just kind of peruse through it. I'd just love to hear any thoughts or input you have. And you mentioned The Power of Three. Is that a book?
No, it's not. And I got to tell you, there may be one out there. Let me just tell you is that, you know, I was putting together a presentation for a fantasy football league here that really does lend a lot to the family aspect of it. And one of my colleagues has won the championship for 3 years in a row. So I just that phrase has kind of been hanging around in my mind. And I built a part of our award presentation around The Power of Three. And it's true. I mean, you think about it, there's a lot of things, you know, in our culture that are circled around the number three. I mean, for instance, I don't mean to get all heavy on you, but no, Father, Son, the Holy Ghost, red, white, and blue. You know, there's a lot of threes that are out there. And I think that when I mentioned, and it really just kind of rolled off my tongue, you, us, and the end person in this whole line, the patient and the family, boy, once you get that thing down, man, you got it, man. That's lightning in a bottle.
It's kind of like a flywheel then, and it's a self-reinforcing thing. And I don't know how to fit this in here, right? But 2 points make a line, but 3 points make a plane, and a plane is sort of the foundation of any existence. You know what I mean?
There it is. There, now we're talking.
I'll dive down a rabbit hole with you, man.
I'm with you all the way, Nick.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, man. This was really, really a phenomenal episode.
So I appreciate the opportunity, and it really is an honor to do this, Nick. And I'm here for you whenever you need me. That's for sure.